Hello again. Welcome to our To The Point podcast. I'm Warren Alney. Did COP27 make any progress in the fight against climate change? David Wallace Wells tells us the meeting of world leaders wasn't as bad as it looked. And he says the future of global warming isn't as bad as he thought it was just a few years ago. We'll hear from him, but first, the historic protest of a new generation of women against Iran's Islamic Revolution. If you weren't paying attention, it cropped up at this year's World Cup when Iran attacked the U.S. for a symbolic gesture on behalf of Iranian women's rights. Robin Wright, who reports for The New Yorker about her frequent trips to Iran, tells us how things are changing in Iran itself and in diplomatic relations. So, Robin Wright, thank you so much for joining us.
Always great to be with you, Warren.
This is a far cry from the last time that the United States and Iran met in the World Cup.
It is indeed. In 1998, both President Clinton in the United States and President Khatami in Iran had been working for basically almost a year to try to better connections between the two, largely through person-to-person or track-to diplomacy. And President Clinton even said at the time that both nations had been working to encourage exchanges and to help people develop a better understanding of each other's rich civilizations. Today, you see, in some ways, unprecedented tensions between the two nations, probably not as bad since the early days of the revolution in the late 1970s and early 1980s.
What all this is about, of course, is a challenge to the revolutionary regime by women. Tell us how that began and how it's working out right now.
The protest began on September 16th after the death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old Kurdish woman who was visiting Tehran. And the morality police objected to her headscarf. Apparently, her hair wasn't covered sufficiently. And she was hauled away to a detention center. What we don't know is what happened in the vehicle, because once she got to the detention center, she collapsed. And there is video of that, which has gone viral on social media. And she was taken to a hospital where she fell into a coma and died 3 days later. And this led to protests, spontaneous eruption, particularly in Kurdish area that quickly spread to Tehran and other cities, about issues not over just the hijab or the head cover for girls and women, but also over the issue of personal freedom and women's rights. And this is interesting that for the first time in human history, you are beginning to see a counter-revolution that was ignited by women, led by women, in which women are the primary force. It's been remarkable. And whatever its fate, these protests will go down in history for the role of women.
Elaborate, if you will, on the repression of women's rights in Iran, which I take it is quite severe compared to other places around the world. To what extent there has been an agitation about this over the years?
Well, in many ways, Iranian women are better off than women in Saudi Arabia. At least women in Iran have the vote. They are members of parliament. There's a female vice president. There has been under earlier presidents as well. The interesting thing and the dynamic that fostered these protests is really the fact that women are better educated. And it's very striking. During the monarchy, many traditional families didn't send their girls to school beyond the sixth grade because they were afraid that their girls would be exposed to miniskirts and makeup and Western mores. But after the revolution, traditional families sent their girls not only into higher education, but through universities. And 60% of the university student body in Iran today is female. And that has rippled through society, women aware of their place, their rights. And so you see Gen Z girls born between 1997 and 2012 who are well-educated. They want a place in society. They didn't suffer the hardships of earlier generations during the revolution, the post-revolutionary trauma, the war with Iraq, the efforts to kind of reconstruct. And so they don't accept the social contract anymore of protection by the regime or welfare by the regime as sufficient. They want rights. And so what you've seen is a real transformation that has been shaped by education and demographics. And, you know, women in Iran have always been allowed to drive. So when you talk about the rights of women, it's very different than some of the Gulf countries.
So they're not then, I'm incorrect in saying that women have been more severely repressed in Iran than in other places.
Well, they do have to cover themselves in terms of modesty. But one of the things that's been striking me, and I go to Iran, you know, quite often, is that the girls have been pushing the limits of hijab or headscarf for decades. I've gone to commemorations at the anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. embassy, which was very traumatic for Americans and is still commemorated in Iran, and I've watched the girls who once had to be covered in chadors and even their ankles covered, and now wearing jeans, very short covers over their legs, their headscarves precariously perched on the backs of their head. And I've marveled at how they do it, you know, black nail polish, makeup, and so forth. So you've seen the push for this for a long time, women testing the limits. And it took a trigger, a flashpoint, and that was the death of Mahsa Amini. That was something that ignited the imagination of Iranian women who've been pushing the limits for a long time. And now to do even more in challenging the regime, challenging the leadership, and shouting things like death to the dictator.
How are the men responding to this?
Well, it's striking that from their early days, a lot of the Gen Z men, young men, joined the protests. What we are all waiting to see is if the older generations join in these protests as well, which have been led largely by the young. The regime at one point announced that the average age of the people being arrested was 17. And so this really is a younger generation challenging the older one, the next two generations. And we haven't seen the kind of turnout by the older generations yet that might determine the fate of the regime.
Well, have we seen the police that you described taking more and more extreme measures against these young protesters?
Absolutely. And the regime has traditionally cracked down hard on protests. They did during more than 6 months of protests in 2009, when millions took to the streets across Iran to demand new elections because of allegations of fraud in a presidential election, or in 2017 over the price of poultry, or in 2019 over sudden gas price hikes. So the regime dispatches riot police, besiege these paramilitary wing of the Revolutionary Guards. It's engaged in draconian mass trials, the arrest of thousands. The international human rights groups claim there have been at least 15,000 arrested, more than 300 killed. And we know of at least six cases where young people have been charged with penalties that carry the death penalty. And these are all sending messages to the young protesters that the government intends to clamp down. So the question, of course, is what's the longevity of these protests? How persistent will they be? And how much further might the government go in trying to stop them?
What have we heard from the Ayatollah? To what extent is there any indication that he or the regime itself might try to resolve things in a more peaceful way?
The supreme leader has repeatedly insisted that the protests have been instigated, fomented, and supported by Iran's enemies, including the United States and Israel and Saudi Arabia. There's a sense that the government is so isolated, so disconnected from the population, that they don't realize the depth of antipathy toward the government. Remember, last year, Iran held presidential elections, and for the first time, the majority did not turn out to vote. Only 49% of the population elected a hardline leader. And I think the government has tried to lay the blame elsewhere and doesn't understand that the Gen Z generation just no longer is willing to tolerate. And one important thing to know about the protests is that they cross ethnic and kind of tribal and all the different aspects, geographic divisions of Iran, that young generation may not have a vision of what the alternative is, but they certainly don't like the system in the Islamic Republic.
I asked earlier about the position of men. You said that is yet to be seen, but apparently young men, certainly as indicated by the Iranian soccer team, are very much on the side of the protesters.
Well, the Iranian national soccer team decided not to sing the national anthem during their first meeting with Wales. But they did sing the national anthem on their second in their second game. And so one of the questions is, has the government come down hard and said, sing or else? It's interesting, in 1998, during halftime, the Iranian officials came into the locker room and said, we're taking away your passports, and you won't get them back if you don't beat the United States.
Whoa. And that had to do with winning the game.
That's how important this game is. Soccer is incredibly popular in Iran, and sports in general. They're big on basketball, big on wrestling, and they like to compete against the United States as a way of showing that Iran is more powerful and can beat the United States. It's a symbolic thing, as well as a sports thing for the Iranians.
You talked earlier about the conditions that have existed in Iran and how women have been educated in such an so differently than they have in other countries. What about social media? How important has it been?
Well, social media has been incredibly important, and it was again in 2009. Iran was the first place that they used social media to broadcast the protests and inspired many others in the Arab Spring in 2011. So the government, one of its tools has been to cut off access to the internet so that people have limits on how they can broadcast videos of the protests. And we've depended on those because to find out what's happening inside Iran, because so few outside the country have had access. So they have used social media as they can. Instagram is arguably the most popular. Telegram is popular as well as a way of broadcasting what's going on and how far the Iranian kids are willing to go.
Given the isolation of the regime that you just talked about earlier, are there any figures of leadership who might actually challenge the supreme leader?
Not so far. One of the interesting things has been that the former reform leaders, President Rouhani, who was in power until August last year, President Khatami earlier this century, have been silenced throughout. And of course, one of the questions is, has the government silenced them? President Khatami had been banned from foreign travel, from being quoted in the Iranian media, and this predates the protests. One of the most dangerous positions in Iran is to be a former president because the government tries to isolate them once they leave office and quiet their voices. So in 2009, we saw the losing presidential candidates provide a kind of leadership. Former Prime Minister Mousavi and former Speaker of Parliament Karoubi. But they were put under house arrest, and a decade later, they are still under house arrest. So it's a dangerous thing to do is to get out in public and support protest movements. So it's been striking that no former leaders in Iran and some of the kind of familiar voices on reform efforts or in challenging the government have been silenced as well.
Well, it sounds like this is the most significant challenge to the regime since the revolution. What are the chances that there will be a lot more bloodshed before there's any kind of change?
I fear there will be a lot more bloodshed, but the idea of bringing about change is one that is you know, there, a lot of people wish that there would be either a change in the regime's behavior or a change in government. But the 2009 protests went on for more than 6 months and did not manage to bring about change. And this will take a cross-generational, cross-geographic involvement by many more people to actually bring about change. The one problem is that the young generation knows what it's against, but it doesn't have a leadership, an organization, or an idea about what replaces the regime, which is very deeply entrenched. So the idea that we'll see change tomorrow, I think, is illusory. The one big question is the health of the supreme leader. He's now 83, and a European diplomat told me several weeks ago that he again has cancer. He suffered from prostate cancer in 2014, and apparently some kind of cancer has recurred, diplomats say. So the question is, do these protests intersect with the looming transition of a man who's been the ultimate power now since 1989, 3 decades?
Well, thank you so much for bringing us up to date. It's extraordinary to find somebody with such access to a place that is so mysterious to most of us. Robin Wright, many thanks as always. Great to talk with you.
Great to talk with you, Warren.
COP27, this year's meeting of international leaders, has been widely panned for its failure to make measurable progress against climate change. But David Wallace Wells says it's still possible to be hopeful. Back with him in a moment on To the Point.